Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Form Zen Fighting Champion John Chung, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, protecting the history, one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Aloha, everyone, and welcome to the AMAA Masters Radio Show and Network. What an exciting show I have tonight. You know, I get to honor and pay respect to everybody daily at the Sport Karate Museum, but there's a few people that I've interviewed on the show that I just get all giddy about, and tonight's show is about that type of person, and I'm going to bring him on in just a few minutes. We're very happy to be in your home tonight on a Tuesday evening, and you've allowed us to do that for 2 years now. And I want to have a big shout-out to my co-host, Karen Erdman, and Mrs. Bowen, and, of course, Hachi Bowen, my producer, in his own show. And we're very proud of what we've done in these 2 years by being able to come in your homes and share with you 24-7 our radio network. But allowing sport karate history and what we accumulated here in America to have a show based on that and talking about the legends, the pioneers, it's so special, so special. And I thank you. And I can't really thank you enough every time I'm on the air. You know, the heart of our show is a book, believe it or not. It's called The Who's Who in the Martial Arts. And for people that have been around for quite a few years, you understand that book was developed by Jan Wallendorf and a gentleman named Dale Brooks. And I believe it was 1981, 82 when they first developed the first book. And I was in the first cover, and also in the second edition. And then years go by, and we do so many different things. And a few years back, I started getting responses from my friend, Mr. Corley, and introduced me to an all-time karate competitor who I heard of and never met. It was Hansi Jesse Bowen. And I come to find out he was a student of Jan Wallendorf and Dale Brooks. And he wanted to carry the vision of what these two gentlemen did with the book, Who's Who in the Martial Arts, to a different level, and that's what he's done. He surrounded it with a banquet, a ring, incredible bios of people who've created stories in America. And his event this year is August the 3rd at with the Dennis Brown NASCAR event. And for more information, contact Hunter Jesse Bowen on Facebook, or you can actually get involved with the book at Amazon.com, or you can go to Martial Arts, Century Martial Arts, or Barnes & Noble. So please, check the book out. It's a great book. You know, I've got the interview tonight with someone, like I said, very special. You know, critics, magazine editors, producers, writers, black belts, pioneers, history generals, you know, of sport karate and legends have all said and written that, you know, he may have been the best traditional black belt kata performer in the history of the sport. You know, of course, we're talking about Mr. John Chung. You know, protege of Grandmaster Jun Ri of Washington, D.C. and the Jun Ri Institute of Taekwondo. You know, earning his black belt in 1974, Mr. Chung started blazing his path early. You know, one of his early tournaments was Larry Bullitt's Appalachian Open, I remember, in Boone, North Carolina in the early 70s. You know, he took first place and a second place to Bobby Tucker, and a third, you know, went to a black belt with more third places than anybody in the universe. You know, some lucky Hawaii guy. Mr. Chung would, you know, become great in the upcoming years, being a threat in tournaments and getting stronger than others, for he was gifted with a gift that I call sweet, humble attitude, a champion's champion, an attitude in and out of the ring. And let me remind you, he was a fighter, too, and a good fighter. However, we were blessed in watching him become the role model. He became, as a mesmerizing black belt, kata performer of perfection. The incredible classic showdowns with his friend competitor, Mr. George Chung, were incredible to watch. You know, George with his long ranger and triple shotgun kicks, you know, routine. And then John with his Beethoven's, you know, Exodus traditional flawless kata, perfection. I remember getting goosebumps watching them over and over around the country. And in my dedication, training involved to perform at that level of intensity. You know, we were all half black, no real travel back then. But, you know, I will ask John personally tonight, you know, how he started and why, and how did he get involved, and how did he get to the level that he achieved? You know, what about his World Cup championships that he's done yearly now for so many years? And are you, John, the biggest Mickey Mouse fan of the world? Enjoy this exclusive interview with a true pioneer of sports karate legacy, truly. World champion, John Chun, perfection of kata. Hey, John, are you there on the line, sir?
I am right here. Thank you, Gary. I am right here.
Well,
honored to be here.
Well, thank you, John. And it's such a really, really exciting moment to sit here in the studio and be able to interview you like this live. And you'll be listening, hundreds of listen to it, you know, tomorrow and you know, tonight, even after we get done. You know, we go back a few years. Like I said, we go back to the 70s, back when I guess we were going to
a few years,
year.
Right?
Going to, yes, sir, going to college. And it was amazing times back then, and all the people that we were around, like Michael Goldman and Jeff Mr. Smith and all those people that turned out to be incredible martial artists, and you. I'm so proud of you, and I've always shared that with you because I've always admired you, not just because of your martial arts ability, but your personality. I've always enjoyed your kindness and your sweet words. And so with that said, John, I'd like to know how you got started. Who was your first influence? And what year exactly did you make black belt? I think it was 74, you said, but just lead me up to that level.
Well, I started Taekwondo back in the 1970. I had just came from Korea. September of 1970, and I started Taekwondo, waited about a month or two, late October, early November of 1970, not knowing that my uncle was going to be a grandmaster, father of United States Taekwondo, Jun Ri.
Wow, yeah,
When I was coming over here from Korea, I had heard that one of my aunts had married this Taekwondo guy, you know. So we're like fascinated, looking forward to it. And I was only 12 years old. And when we came here, he was there's a little man, you know, and I was like, wow, he's very little. And yes, I was little too, but, you know, Grandmaster Jun Ri, he, in the ring, he's a giant. In the class, he's a giant, but when you just see him, he's a little, you know, small Asian gentleman. But I was lucky, blessed enough to be part of the family, started the Taekwondo training right away, and I was hooked. I mean, I was hooked back in when I was in Korea, but we just were not able to, I was not able to do the Taekwondo, so when I came and I heard that that was something that we're going to do because it's part of our family. I was hooked even before I even went to class. And, of course, when I went to class, I was already hooked. It was my brother and I, Howard. He's 3 years older than I, and my sister, Helen. Helen did not start because at that time we just felt that, you know, for whatever the reason, again, this is back in 1970, so it was more of male. And even I was a little bit young for the sport. There weren't really that many kids. So at age 12, I had Philip Chung and Charlie Lee, Philip Chung being my cousin. He was, he's six years younger than I, and Charlie Lee, 5 years younger than I. And Charlie Lee was seven, Philip was six, and they were yellow belts at that time when I started. So they had already been training for a little while, and I asked them how long they've been training, and they go, "Oh, we've been training for like many years." And of course, the little kids.
So Charlie is another person that used to give me goosebumps in the Twilight Zone. And just amazing, amazing. You got
so now,
an incredible
you know,
group of family
back,
people.
You know, way back, right? So we're talking about close to 50 years now here.
See? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Almost half a century. So we're going back. And then, you know, it was just something that we did every day. And it wasn't like, you know, do you want to do Taekwondo or, you know, do you like it? It was something that we felt like, or I felt like we're supposed to do as Korean, as a family. And I went every day. went Monday through Saturday. So Monday I would finish school. My mother would drive us. We lived in Arlington, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C. And my mother would drive us every day. She'd pick us up, drove us to D.C., and we would stay there and, you know, help out. We were also a janitors there, so we cleaned the school. And just like, you know, Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi type of principal, we cleaned. And we took classes, sometimes two, three, four classes a day. And at the end of the day, my uncle, not Jun Ri, but Jun Ri's brother-in-law, K.K. Chung, who was a general manager of the school, he would bring us home. And that was a routine. Saturday morning, he would pick us up. We'd go there, we'd stay there all day, and we would come home. So it wasn't like, I don't want to say whether we had a choice or not. We loved it, but it was just something that we did.
It was part of the family
part of our
culture
life.
And tradition. Yeah, it was just part of the family culture and tradition. And for my listeners who aren't part of the understanding a lot of where the old people, not the old people, but the elders and the pioneers came from, that was the way it was back then. You know, John, the other thing that really fascinated about you is that once you became a black belt, once you started competing, when did it come about that you realized that you had a gift that was something different? And it's not just your perfect, and that's what people have claimed it to be, a 10, that sidekick that went straight up in the air and changed it perfectly, to the synchronization of what Master Ri's vision was to choreograph kata, which he invented. When did you realize that you had that ability, or I'm going to say greatness, I'm going to go ahead and say it because it's my show. When did you realize you had that greatness that was going to make you just different?
You know, I want to say, I'm saying this to you, Gary, as a friend, as a martial artist, as an individual, I don't ever felt like I had that.
Yes,
and I think maybe that's why I continue to work hard. I felt like I was at the right time, at the right place. I was very lucky, very blessed. I worked hard for it. But when I looked out in the competition field, when I traveled all over the world, United States, I saw so many talented people. I competed with so many talented people. And many times I felt like they were better than I. And I think that drove me to work harder. At no point I felt like I was better than them or I was more so-called, as you said, you know, gifted or this and that. I worked for it, you know, and I was lucky enough to have, you can say win or do well, but I mean,
you were part of that great era of, I was called, say, the heyday, where for the first time, where you didn't really understand it, but you were having fans. You had fans. You had people that would cheer your name and just really look forward to you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I thought. But, you know, also, I was a fan of many people. You know,
absolutely.
I was, as George, you know, as he was one of my, you know, as you said, fierce competitor. But I felt like he was my younger brother. You know,
you guys are yin and yang. John, you guys are yin and yang. Beautiful. It was like God's vision of how it should be, both of you guys on stage. That's
he
what
loved
I believe.
Entertain. You know, I work, you know, coming from the Jun Ri heritage, those people from Texas knows. You know, Mr. Ri, he was ahead of his time.
Yes.
You know, he was looking for perfection, but not only perfection, but he was also looking for application. So it wasn't just do it. He had to make sure it worked. And if it didn't work.
John, part of the show tonight, John, was to be able to share our love for Grandmaster Jun Ri and a couple of things that I'd like to mention. And I think it's really, really important is that, you know, one of the things I'm doing in the 21st coming up, I'm celebrating Mr. Bertelsen's birthday party along with Jamie Cashin's graduation. And a lot of your students and friends are people like Mr. Smith and Mr. Worley and all those guys are coming in. And a few years back, Master Ri, you know, years ago, gave a black belt to Mr. Alan Sting, which he wore, and he gave it to Mr. Sting. Mr. Sting wore it, and then, of course, he wore it for many years, and he gave it to Mike Stone, My son gave it to J. Pat Burleson, and they all wore it. And Mr. Burleson gave it to Mr. Harrison, and he wore it. And a few years back, Mr. Harrison actually gave it to me, and I have it now encased. And every time I talk to people like yourself that have the lineage of Master Rhee, I always tell that story because I think it's so important, and it's part of the heart of what I do, to have that belt in the possession of the history. So,
right.
That's
what you do.
That's the reason such an important person.
You gotta keep the history going, or as well as you have to, teach myself and all the up and coming young'uns who will carry the tradition of martial arts. And, that's the beauty of it.
How did the Europeans accept you? I mean, is it like everybody else just because,
it.
I mean, we have slanted eyes, and that's what I had when I was a young black belt, that you automatically know karate. But I'm just curious, how did the Europeans accept the great John Chung performing? Was it just the Americans?
I was fortunate enough, blessed enough to be at the right time at the right place. I mean, if you really think about it, first time I went to Battle of Atlanta, first time, I think it was 1978 or 79, I can't really remember, Joe Corley, huge, the Georgia Tech Coliseum, right?
Right, absolutely.
And we had one black belt division, one form black belt division. And I think there was like about 100 of us there.
Wow.
There were 10 judges. 10 judges, I mean, mind you. Okay?
Wow.
10 judges. So that was my first so-called, a national type of a tournament. If you won Battle of Atlanta, you were like a national champion back then,
Amen.
And even so now.
Yeah.
But, just think about it. There were how do you keep track of that many competitors, first of all?
Right.
There were 10 judges. And that is a competition.
Amen.
I competed. That was first my so-called a big national tournament. I had competed in the PKN Nationals in Baltimore. That's local. Locally, we weren't, junior schools really weren't that favored, but I won. And I felt like that was my so-called milestone of getting into the so-called national circuit. And then I, did well at Battle of Atlanta. When I went to Europe, by the time I went to Europe, Karate Illustrated, Black Belt magazines, all these magazines had already published my name. They knew me better than I knew myself.
I counted 14 covers. Is that close?
Thank you. I don't know.
I think 14 covers, brother. I do my research. I think 14.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I do my work. But my favorite one is the one with you and Cynthia and Steve Anderson. And my little brother, Dale Kirby, on the cover. And that's my favorite one, 1981.
Uh-huh.
That's my favorite cover.
I do have many of those magazines in my archives myself. So
absolutely. Yeah. Well, the other thing I want to ask you about is you created a tournament circuit a few years back. And you did that, because you wanted to really bring traditional values back, because the tournament was really cool. And it's called the World Cup, and you've done that now for how many years?
Yeah, well, World Cup organization, we started because we wanted to make the martial arts competition more competitor-friendly. I think the rules and regulations are great, but when you have too many, it confuses the competitor.
TMR, too many rules, exactly.
When the parents and spectators know the rules better than the competitors, we have a problem. It's the competitors who should know the rules, coaches who should know the rules, so they're able to train correctly, implement it correctly, and go out there and be the best that you can be. But when the spectators are out there correcting the judges and or competitors and say, hey, you did this wrong, you did that wrong, we have a problem. When you have the competitors in the ring.
Let me ask you a question, John. How do you feel about the fact that when we started, there was two or three groups, NASCAR, NBL, of course, the old USK was fighting out. And now there's probably close to 50 different groups and organizations in the country that black belts have to choose from to be able to compete mm-hmm. in. And there's always the elite
right.
few that are up there. But would you ever think there'd be that many people, you know, be able to put together groups like that to have different groups and organizations?
I am for all these organizations because they're trying to do it right for the sport.
Yes.
You know, not one organization it will try to go out there and so-called try to hurt the sport. They're out there, and if they're successful, they're going to stick around, which many of the organizations have been. NBL
yeah.
is a perfect example. I mean, it's been around for a long time, NASCAR. You have WKC, and then, you know, there's tons.
Right.
That also shows that there are that many martial artists. There
are you an
AAU,
Brad? Like a lot of us?
No.
Are you an AAU?
No.
You
no.
AAU?
We, I went through a little bit. I support everything and every organization because I love the diversity. You know, as a competitor, your job is to go out there and compete, but you have to know the rules. So being able to adjust and adapt to different rules and regulations, I enjoy that.
John,
unfortunately, not everybody
does.
So in terms of having lots of organization, I'm for it. You know, because it gives an individual an opportunity to do, you know, the best that they can do.
That's a really good point. I want to ask you right off the bat, and this is in my list of Zig Ziglar's to ask list.
Who? I'm sorry?
Zig Ziglar. I'm a big fan of Zig Ziglar.
Okay.
And he taught me to always write things down, so I wrote these down to ask you.
okay.
I know I put people on the spot that I've interviewed because that's what I do. But I want to ask you, there's always going to be that one competitor that got you up, that fired you up. Now, I knew the probably most fun one was George because it was so much fun to watch him compete against you. But there had to be another competitor that really got you fired up personally that you knew you had to get out there and own the ring. Was there somebody you can tell me that really fired you up?
Wow. You know, I mean, if you look
at
the
time frame, a lot of good people. I know.
When I competed,
I'm putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, there were just so many, and you know, I don't want to say it was us because if you look, okay, here's Cynthia Rothrock, right? She kind of ruled the women's division,
yes.
And then George Chung with his, you know, flair, and then there's Ernie Reyes Jr. I mean, he competed with adults, remember?
And
you know,
little Ernie,
Kane,
absolutely.
You know, little Ernie, and then you had, you know, Dale Kirby, sharp as nail, I mean, there were so many, and then more toward like mid '80s, later years of '80s, you had Keith Hirabayashi coming up, Philip Wong.
Yes, he could.
I mean, there were.
They're calling now.
Anthony Chan came a few times. Peter Morales was there. I mean, if you name all these people you're talking about, they were all champions.
Yes,
so
they were.
It wasn't like any one competitor that,
little brother.
You know,
yeah,
any one competitor that kind of fired you up.
Thank
is like, okay.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, I even said it to these guys. Hey, guys, you know, we're going to go out there. We're going to put in the best show. It's not up to us.
Yeah.
It's up to the judges. And that's what it was. It was up to the judges. You know, and
I got another question
to
ask you. Where did Carmichael Simon come from? Because he's my little brother. I love him to death. And I know that he was a great, great little competitor and he's in Gene Green. But where did he come from? Where did Carmichael come from? You know
Carmichael, I'm not sure where he originally started, but I know he was training with Charlie Lee.
Okay.
So by that time, I was already out of the picture. Of competition, you know, Charlie Lee, he was my student, and he came after me.
Right.
And then after him, so when Carmichael Simon came up, Charlie Lee kind of took him under his wings and worked with him.
Yeah, I like Carmichael a lot. When he moved to Texas a few years back, I met him through Rick Arnold, and I just You know, he was one of those kids I watched grow up. So the lineage of Master Rhee, what he did with, and like I said, it's incredible the people that he's trained and he's influenced. But I want to go back to another question that's personal. You know, when Creative Forms was created, and a lot of people don't realize that he was the one that brought choreographed dancing or musical to forms. Eric Lee was given credit for it too, but Mr. Rhee is the one that really brought it to the limelight, I believe. And you are such known as a traditional guy, John, but you transformed to, you did Exodus, and you did the Beethoven Fifth Symphony. What was your mind adjustment to be able to do Creative Form to traditional? Because I know the same thing, I did the same thing with Sword, and it was controversial. How did you adjust to it?
You know, you have to understand the Junmi system. Junmi system, like I said earlier, we grew up, we trained in a system where you work to perfection. You know, Mr. Rhee always said, you know, work for your maximum, and when you've reached your maximum, hunt for new maximum. So with the tradition, he was working, and he got to a point where, okay, there's a lot of theory, a lot of philosophy behind it, but he needed that application. And I think the cross of him and Bruce Lee training together gave that spark where Mr. Rhee wanted to kind of combine the philosophy of Eastern art and the practicality of the Western philosophy and put it together. That's why he created a safety equipment. He invented it. He was the one who kind of, with Joe Corley, PKA, kind of ignited that full contact knockout. Let's see if this stuff really works. And, you know, when full contact first came in, a lot of these rough and tough point fighters, they got into the ring and they got knocked out. They weren't so tough.
I'd always love to hear the behind-the-scenes hotel and Denny's meetings that were held by those old-timers to help invent the point going from point karate to full contact to kickboxing. I always thought that was really interesting.
And that's why we have the legends like Joe Louis, first heavyweight.
Yes.
Jeff Rest Smith, first light heavy. Bill Wallace, first middleweight. These guys were great point fighters, and those were the only three who were able to transform their fighting style into full contact and continue to succeed.
Did you ever fight full contact, John? Did you ever fight full contact at all?
I fought full contact two rounds, and I'm 1-1. I won.
I beat that record. John, I went 3-3, and I got knocked out in the third round. So I got tired. Well, I fought Demetrius Oakley Edwards. Remember Oakley Edwards?
I lost to my instructor, Mr. Otis Super. I was 16 years old.
Well, I did an exhibition fight with Oaktree Edwards, and he knocked me out. So don't get in the ring with a guy named Oaktree. Don't get in the ring with a guy named Oaktree. Okay, that's a bad
habit. That's right.
You realize that you were a fighter too. You fought on Waco too in Europe,
yes.
Correct?
I fought for Waco for many years. I have I did have a gold medal, and I have two bronze medals from Waco. Fighting.
Right.
So, and you know, I've won many local tournaments as well as the grand champions and here and there and stuff. And I fought in the Battle of Lana. I was seeded a few times, just different way. But, you know, we did it again. It didn't matter whether it was form or fighting. You got out there and just did the best that you can.
Right.
And that's what the competition was all about.
Well, we're talking about Walker. I got to mention this. And this year we're honoring the women, the power of women. So I've got to mention Helen and her influence. And, you know, she was a great kata champion. She was a great fighter. But something I found on the internet, and I just loved it. I showed it to my black belts and people who know that I admire you. They just enjoyed watching it. You were on Dance Fever with Helen.
Doing
kata. And dancing. Tell me about that and how that came about. That was so cool.
Well, you know, back in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, we loved the disco. Disco was the part of it. We got there, we danced, and dance was part of our cardio. We would go to the, you know, clubs, and we would dance for 2-3 hours nonstop and just work up a sweat. And it was just a workout for us. But with the music, it was a fantastic workout. And we introduced Jeff Smith to disco, world champion. He's my senior. He's my senior. He's like my big brother. And
I talked to him today. Yeah.
He got into dancing, and his wife, Kim, she was a dancer. And then also her dance partner, David Nice. He also is right now owns a school. And they saw Helen and I doing a demonstration or something, and then David Nice and Kim approached Jeff and said, you know what, this might be a great opportunity for us to do so-called martial arts ballet introduced to, you know, Dance Fever. So Helen and I, we thought about it. Kim Smith, she helped us choreograph some of the moves, martial arts move, changed a little bit more, you know, dance moves. And we did a martial arts ballet. You know, we didn't disco dance.
What place did you take? How'd you end up doing?
We took second.
Okay.
We took second
cool.
To a fantastic, phenomenal disco dancers from New York. And I heard that they ended up winning the, you know, $10,000 grand championship. So that was a big thing. But after us, the second year, Charlie Lee and Regina Gonzalez went in 81. And then following year, Steve McGill and I can't remember who went, but they went. So we had three couples of martial artists go. I mean, yes, Helen and I were the first. After that, to introduce martial arts ballet to the, you know, on a national TV show, Dance Fever.
It was cool.
Just in case, a lot
really
of listeners, you
that.
Don't know what Dance Fever is. Dance Fever is before, like, Who Can Dance? What's the show, right?
Right,
Who
exactly.
Can Dance?
But, you know, you're talking to a guy that invented Disco Club in Greenville, South Carolina called the Electric Warehouse, so I know about Disco, bro.
You know, you take Dance Fever to kids right now, and they go, huh? What is Dance Fever? So you have to put it into, like, in a show right now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, I've got to ask you this, too. Are you the biggest Mickey Mouse fan in the world?
I think so. You know, my wife and I.
You think so? I think so.
We love Disney. You know.
Yeah.
Who does not love Disney? And the things I say, Disney makes people happy, and it gives people hope. I mean, what do you know? I mean, that's awesome. And I only wear Mickey Mouse tie. I think you know. And about, I want to say 20 years ago, one of my sidekick member student named Eric Ogunzucker, and he knows that I love Mickey Mouse and I love Disney, and I'm a patriot. So he got me a little Mickey Mouse pin, form of American flag. And back then, it was almost impossible to find that. And he got that for me. And I think he said he found it, I'm not sure where. And I would wear that. Now,
well,
when I go to
that inclusion, yeah, that makes you are the biggest Mickey Mouse fan, probably, in martial arts.
I wear that everywhere, and I wear the tie. I would have the watch. I have Mickey Mouse Golf Club head covers, so I call it.
Okay.
I play Mickey Mouse Golf.
Right. See, I'm right.
You know,
I did right.
You have to
that.
Enjoy.
Yeah.
So thank you for recognizing that.
Well, I think it's cool. It's just one of your cool traits. Listen, I'm going to take a little break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to play the Legends Name Game. This is going to be a lot of fun because a lot of people you sent me, and we're going to talk about their personal things, too. So the Sport Card Museum will have their 2 cents, too, and I'll bring you back in just a few minutes. So stay tuned, John. Don't go nowhere, okay?
Thank you. I'm right here.
Okay, brother. Hey, we're talking to the world champion, the one and only John Chung. And this is a really fun interview because, you know, as most of you know, most of these guys I do interview, they're personal friends. So it's just like sitting down and having a cup of coffee and talking to your old friend that you've known for 30 or 40 years. I've got some upcoming events I want to talk about, and they're exciting, and I want to get right into it right now. this week coming up, right around the corner, is the one and only Bill Wallace event, World Championship in Cleveland, Ohio, put together by Mr. Richie McClain and Mr. Don DeVries. Now, this event basically is going to be a one-of-a-kind event at the amusement park there in Cleveland, and also it's a combination of the Cleveland Martial Arts Hall of Fame with banquet and gathering. They're introducing Bubble Kumite, and they're going to have an event that's going to kind of blow the lid off. It's PKC regional rated. It's also rated also by the Sport Karate Museum. And Bill Wallace will be there, and I understand that Jeff Smith is going to be receiving the Superfoot Award this year at the banquet, and this is April the 14th in Cleveland, Ohio. For more information, you can contact Don DeVries or Rich McClain on Facebook. Right around the corner also that following week on the 21st of April, Jamie Cashin, the Ambassador of Martial Arts for America, will celebrate his 8th-degree black belt celebration, along with J. Pat Burleson's birthday celebration. And coming into that event, wow, Bob Thunder Thurman, George Clark, Jim Anderson, Jim Harrison, Bob Wall, okay, I'm not done, Jeff Smith, okay, I'm not done, Steve Doss, Daryl Stewart, we'll have a booth there, the Sport Karate Museum, and there'll be hundreds of people there to celebrate Mr. Burleson's birthday party and Mr. Cashin's celebration of the 8th-degree black belt, and that's April the 21st. For more information, you go to Facebook and look up Jamie Cashin, all the information is there. May the 12th, Gillies, that's right, in Dallas, Texas, our dear friends, Stephanie Melton, Whit Melton, Wes Melton, and Mr. Steve Melton, the History General of the Sport Karate Museum, will have a tournament at Gillies Nightclub in Dallas, Texas. For more information, contact Wes Melton at Long Eagle Martial Arts on Facebook, and he'll give you all the details. That's May the 12th in Dallas, Texas. May 12th is an important date because think about this. Every time there's an event, no matter where it is in the country, if it deals with children, it's important. And I know that Mr. Melton and the Melton family care about kids. So support that event in Dallas, Texas on May the 12th. July 1st through the 3rd, the Super Show at the Bellagio, Las Vegas, the one and only Super Show, the largest martial arts industry show in the world, put on by Century Martial Arts. We'll be there with our booth, and we'll have our special guest, Mr. Jim Dutton, doing the autographs and telling the war stories, of course, on his book also at the Bellagio in Las Vegas, July 1st through the 3rd. August 3rd, we're going to be in Washington, D.C., the Dennis Brown's event, the NASCAR event, along with the Legends Banquet, celebrating an event that Mr. Bowen has put together under the Who's Who in the Martial Arts book. And he's bringing in Don Severin. That's right, Dan Severin, the 100 UFC champion, the Beast, Cynthia Rothrock, Ms. Linda Denley, John Chung, the gentleman we're interviewing tonight, and Mr. Dana Abbott, the one and only samurai in the 21st century. And don't forget, September 28th and 29th, Kata Wars and the Living Legends Roast of Mikey Rowe Moore. These are some of our events that are coming up, and we ask for you to support them. For more information, you can contact the sportkaratemuseum.org at 713-483-0476, or you want to contact your email, Professor Gary Lee, at gmail.com. You know, I had lunch today with a champion of 2018, and you might have known him by the name of Lump. His real name is Willie Hicks, and I spent 2 hours with this champion, and we're talking about some things that's going on in tournament karate today. So we decided to open a new segment on the show, and it's called Rant and Ramble. You know, I don't understand. I just don't get it. So I won't dwell on it, but it's a new segment, and I want to introduce it. And Mr. Willie Hicks, world champion Willie Hicks, helped me introduce this idea. What I don't get and I don't understand, if someone has an event in the same city and it's sanctioned by the same people and they advertise it on the same day and they're friends, but they have a tournament just miles apart, why would someone do this? Well, this is what's going on in America. I remember when there was one tournament maybe every 3 or 4 months. And it was a big deal to train for that one tournament. Sometimes, way back, it was a tournament once a year. I know, that's crazy, but it was true. And then people said that we can do a tournament, anybody could do a tournament, and they created tournaments around the state. So you had choices to get to. And then someone said, let's make a national tournament, and they invite three three states, and they call it a national tournament, and people would show up. And then someone created a world championship, and four or five states would come, maybe one country like Mexico or Canada, and it was a world championship. What's gone on in America? Why would you do that? Why would you put together an event and be sanctioned in the same group and have two events in the same day in the same state or even the same city? I don't understand. And this is one of the things that Mr. Hicks brought up, what's going on. In America right now, in every state, there's a tournament in almost every city. And sometimes there's 10, 15 tournaments the same weekend. It's crazy what's going on in America as far as tournaments. So what's the solution? Pick and choose your tournament circuit. Support the ones that support you, that have family values, that care about the competitor. Support that circuit and support them in a way that go to their tournaments and, you know, pay their entry fees, pay their spectator fee, buy their concessions. But don't support the tournaments that are going to be people such as the side of the road and that would have an event on the same day as another tournament, because that's just one group of people. Then you have people have to choose. Don't put them in that position. I don't get it. I don't understand. Our new segment. So each week we'll have a new rant and rave. So I hope you enjoy our new segment. Hey, we're going back now to our interviewer, Mr. John Chung. I hope John didn't get run off by my rant and raving. John, are you still there?
I am right here listening to you. Again, thank you for what you
John,
do.
John, how do you feel about having all these tournaments on the same day, same sanction, same city? Is that crazy or crazy?
You know, it's like, I guess, being invited to all these parties on the same day, huh?
Yes. If you had a clone machine, we'd be in good business. But there's no such thing.
Well, I mean,
machine.
You know, and not to say, but I mean, you know, like you said earlier, you know, we'll have, you know, uniform, we'll travel type of a thing. And remember, when we competed, there were a lot of tournaments too, but not in the same day, not in the same city. I mean, I remember one year I competed 54 tournaments, and
yeah.
That's because there's a tournament on a Saturday. And there was tournament on Sunday, but not on the same day. And
right.
It was because somebody had a tournament on a Saturday, they respectfully did it on a Sunday. And it was, you know, on the other side, maybe different state, but it was still a lot more respect, you know.
Right.
And just
well,
like
you know,
there
John,
are tons of...
You and I come from the old school of respect and loyalty. And my feeling is kind of simple. Is that I feel for the parents. That's who I feel for. And also I feel for the competitors. Let me tell you the reason why. Not the producers. Let me tell you the reason why. The parents I feel for because they have to choose to put their money in martial arts in the first place, and then they have to choose to go to a tournament circuit. They could have went to gymnastics, they could have went to badminton, they could play football, they could play baseball, but they chose martial arts. The competitors, I feel for them because they have to choose which circuit is going to give them the best momentum. And they don't sometimes feel them out and know until the hard lesson that was the wrong circuit to support. So, as I said, the message is search out, find the producers that care about the competitor and the spectators and parents and, you know, the judges, because I think that you and I agree upon that the judges need to be more qualified every tournament. They need to have meetings. They need to educate the judges because, as you said, the spectators and the parents know more than the judges, there's a problem there. There's a problem. So,
well, I think it goes with the time, you know. I mean, you have to think about it. You know, I think I'm not sure why you competed, but when I competed for me. I didn't compete so that way I can get on the cover of the magazine. I didn't compete so I can have the spotlight on the limelight. I didn't compete so I can, you know, win trophies or this and that. I competed because I enjoyed competition and trying to do better.
Yes.
Trying to kind of, in a way, see where I stood amongst my peers.
John, little brother, you just asked me why I compete, and I'm gonna share with you that I'm not really made too public, but I'll share.
And you probably compete for the same reason.
Well, no, I have a different reason. I'll share it with you.
Okay.
To me, I'd pay a little entry fee. I could have a chance to win a trophy, no matter what it was. A trophy was cool to me. It didn't matter what it was. And I could hit someone three or four times, many times in 2 minutes. And sometimes, if I was lucky, I could hit four or five people many times. And the bottom line is I wouldn't go to jail. I wouldn't worry about getting arrested. I know that's crazy, John, but I thought like that. So it wasn't about the trophies in the sense, because the trophies are cool, but it was the fact that I could get by with hitting something, showing my karate that worked, and not worry about getting arrested or getting scolded. I don't know.
That makes sense. You can go in there and hit people, and that's why a lot of people did martial arts too, because you could hit people and it was okay. When you take a martial arts picture, you don't have to smile.
No. I've done this about 2 years ago. I created a thing called the Legends Name Game, and every interviewer, I ask you a name, and we get to talk about that person for 2 to 3 minutes. And I was going over some of your list and some of the people I was going to throw at you, and there are also some personal friends. So I've got a couple of people I want to ask you about, not any particular order, but here we go. I'd like to throw the first one at you, and that was your first teacher, Quan Ro. Tell me about him.
Well, Mr. Quan Ro, you thought Mr. Ri was small? Mr. Quan Ro was even smaller.
Okay.
He was, at that time, 1970, he was, I believe, like a fifth degree or sixth degree in Taekwondo. And
wow.
He was like fourth or fifth
important.
Degree in Hapkido. So he was not only a Taekwondo man, but he was also a Hapkido man. So he was able to do a little bit more joint locks, a little bit of the throws and stuff like that. He was, man's man. He was awesome. He was tough. He was kind. And, he always smiled. He had a kindest smile. So I was lucky enough to have that. And he knew I was mischievous. And he was he was there. And he, my brother, also, Grandmaster Jun Ri's son, Jimmy Ri, three of us, they're my elders. Jimmy's 2 years older than me, and my brother Howard is 3 years older than me. So, we were like, I don't want to say three musketeers, but I followed them, and Mr. Quan Ro kept us straight. And he was tough. He was awesome. I got to yellow belt with him. And then after that, my second instructor who took over was Grandmaster now. I mean, he's still active, Mr. Otis Hooper. So if you really look at the names that I've been around when I first started, I mean, you think about it. You come to an organization under Grandmaster Jun Ri, and this gentleman, Quan Ro, was kind, tough. He was awesome with his martial arts. And that somebody that you want a so-called a martial art instructor to be. He was like that.
Cool.
And,
now, you mentioned Jimmy Ri and Howard Chung. You said you guys are three musketeers. I want to ask you a question. Who was the gentleman? Was it Chung Ri? Who was the guy? Who was the Ri that helped run the 1993-1994 Jun Ri Nationals?
Me? Me and Chung.
I know you, but it was Chung
Ri. Chung Ri is Chung Ri is younger brother of Jimmy Ri. Jimmy is the older one.
Okay. Yeah, I like Chung.
And Chung is the younger one. He's the one currently right now. He's the who runs the Jun Ri organization.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
He was so kind to me. I gotta throw this in here. I went to Master.
He's the nicest guy. He was also my student too. So he's the nicest guy. and he runs the Jumi organization, and he is Grandmaster Jumi's right-hand person.
Well, let me tell you a story about him, because he didn't know me from the hill of beans. I flew in, and I was with Sherman Oaks at the time with Pops, and they lost my luggage. And so I went to China, and I didn't know him. And he said, well, I think what I can do, you're about the size of a guy named Billy Pine. Remember Billy Pine?
Yes.
So Billy Pine, Chung introduced me to Billy. Billy Pine allowed me to wear his uniform. Now, I wanted to win Mr. Reed's tournament so bad in Kata, because at the time, I think Tony Lopez, Dan Baker, they're already number one in Texas, and they were all there. And I never beat those guys. I never beat Zuppi Ahmed, never beat any of those guys up there. And so I remember going up to Mr. Reed and thanking him for allowing me to compete in this tournament. And then I saw Michael beat the Squally Sr. And Michael, his son with him. And now, you've helped me before at Michael's event, but you understand the story. You know, I love Michael B. Pasquale Sr. I mean, I loved him. And
well, two great gentlemen, junior and senior, both of them.
Yes, sir. He would stop if I was competing in a tournament, and he'd love to watch me do Japanese kata. And Michael came up to me that day, right before the championship, and said, my dad's in the audience. We were going to leave, but he knows you're doing kata. He's going to stay. I looked for him in the audience, which was huge that day. You were there at the tournament. You know, it was huge. I looked for him, and I finally found him right before I bowed in. John, this is a true story. And I had never beat Zuppi or Tony or Dan Baker or anybody, but I was so inspired that day by Michael B. Pasquale Sr. I took first that day, and I treasure that Junior Reed National event. And that's just one story about Master Reed. I get overwhelmed sometimes when I think about it. Even though I wasn't part of his family, how much he's influenced in what I've done. But anyway, we're talking about Chung Ri. God bless him. Now, let's go to the next person. John Worley and Pat Worley, the two brothers that are in Minnesota now but are from Texas. How have they influenced you?
Well, like I said, when I first came to Washington, D.C., 1970, Quan Ro was the head instructor at Washington, D.C., and Otis Hooper was his assistant. Jeff Smith was teaching at Kensington, Maryland. Pat Worley was teaching at Marlow Heights, Maryland. John Worley was teaching in Annandale, Virginia. Mr. Reed had six schools in Washington metropolitan area, and these black belts at their time were head instructors of all those schools. And so when I was a white belt, so-called, and watching these instructors train, you know, we were looking and training with world champion, national champions, world champion quality instructors, not realizing that these guys were, you know, creme de la creme, but we saw them kind of like, you know, every day. When you see them every day, you think that's how it's supposed to be. And
yes,
I think,
sir,
that's another reason that we train so hard, because when you have these, I guess they were pioneers at that time too, because Pat Worley was a national champion, Jeff Smith was a national champion, you know, all these guys were like, hey, this is how it's supposed to be. There's no other way of doing it. So we were training like champions.
What was the influence that John and Pat have had in you? I mean, were they, did they actually teach you or coach you? Or?
Well, I would see them at the events. I would go to tournaments with them. And I see Jeff Smith and Pat Worley, I see them at a competition, and they would always be on stage on a grand championship. Not just doing fighting, but they were also doing forms. You know, Jeff Smith, he did forms. And Pat Worley, they did forms. So they would do both form and fighting. At Jun Ri Stable, you did both. You always did both. You didn't just do fighting. You didn't just do form. You always did both. John Worley, he traveled everywhere with the demonstration team. He would do women's self-defense, which my sister and I copied and mimicked, and we were able to do lady self-defense when we got a little older. But John Worley was one of the great, you know, greatest teachers, instructor.
You know what's cool, John? I'm going to share this with you. You know what? You know how old I am. I'm an old guy. But I remember how controversial it was when you guys wore red uniforms. That's how far I go back. I remember how controversial it was when you guys wore satin uniforms. and nobody was wearing satin uniforms or the
well, you know how the red uniform came about, right?
Tell me.
Okay, so Grandmaster Juni had this vision. You know, he was ahead of his time. I still think to this day he's genius. He's ahead of his time. Nobody really, you know, got it. We did it because he was Grandmaster Juni, but he was way ahead of his time. I mean, look at safety equipment. He invented that back in the early 70s. Dinosaur. You know, we all had to wear it, and we're like, Mr. Reed, if I hit this guy, it doesn't hurt them, but when they punch me, it hurts me. And Mr. Reed's like, it's okay. It's like, well, it's not okay to me, but we did it. Okay? So that's how it was, right? So, you know, Grandmaster being ahead of his time, when he developed the World Black Belt League. Do you remember that? World Black Belt League?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Okay. So
yes.
This is back in the 70s. He, you know, he said, I want to have, just like NFL, you know, city versus city, country versus country. So we wore red uniform because Washington Redskins.
Wow.
When we had the New York teams come. You know, New York teams, they wore green uniforms. Dallas, blue uniforms. And we did a halftime show at RFK Stadium with the Washington Redskins when they played, you know, when they played Eagles. They had a green uniform from the Philly. When they played Dallas, they had a blue uniform. So we would go out there and, you know, of course, we always won. So Redskins red uniform team would knock out, you know, the Dallas Cowboys, and the audience loved it. And that's how these colored uniform came into play.
Wow, that's cool. That's cool history right there. I love that story.
And,
you know
that's
we're talking about Matthew
blessed.
Junry, and we can talk about him a lot, but I gotta
oh,
tell
yeah,
my favorite story, John.
I have stories.
I gotta share with you my Master John. I gotta share with you my favorite Junry story. And I told this to everybody that are close to him, but I don't think I've ever told you. So I'd like to share it with you. It's really, really a fun one. 1994, Super Grands, Hollywood, California. And I'm emceeing the Super Grands with Scott Hogarth. And Michael Chat was the number one competitor in NASCAR at the time. Mr. Liddell was not really happy with what I had done that day because I'd been disqualified for the very first four ki rule in Japanese kata that day. So I wasn't a very happy camper, but I had to get my job to be the MC. And Scott Hogarth helped me. He kept me focused. But anyway, I put Michael Chat to open the Super Grands. That didn't make Mr. Liddell too happy, but right in the middle of Michael Chat's performance, I get a call from security. And in back, security's all upset. He says, this little Oriental man is trying to get in the back area, but he has no pass. And he's asking for Gowie. Not Gary, but Gowie. And I don't know who called me Gowie, except for, you know, Oriental people who can't pronounce Gary. But I didn't know who it was. So I got up, and I said, Scott, excuse me. I go back. Of course, it's Master Reed. And you know, he was surprised, everybody. It was 1994. No one knew he was going to be there, Hollywood. And he asked for me because he knew me. So I tell the security guard, I said, sure, you got to let in with Grandmaster Junior E, father of Taekwondo in America. I went on and on. Right? I was excited. Security guard didn't care. You know, Mr. Liddell just trained these security guards not to care.
Yep.
If he didn't have a pass, he wasn't going to let him in. He grabbed my kimono, John, and I just kind of put my arm around the security guy, and I swept him before. I didn't hurt him or anything. I swept him. I grabbed Mr. Reed by the arm, and I started walking fast down the hallway. And I go, Master Reed, the voice is going to kill me. He's going to kill me. And he goes, I'll never forget, John. He goes, Gowie, don't worry. Just give me the microphone. I will take care of it. That's all he said to me. I walked up to Scotty. I said, Scott, there's been a whole change of plans. Forget about the script. Master Reed's here. And Scott's eyes got really huge, man. I gave Master Reed the microphone, and John, this is so cool. He does his 100 push-ups in 1 minute. He does the sidekick with a glass of water on his head, tells jokes, was a highlight for 20 minutes. It was just so pure and so pure Master Reed. Boyce didn't say anything to me about Michael Chad. He didn't say to me about anything about the security guard because I had Master Reed go on stage. Now, a year later, I get this huge box and it's full of Master Reeves personal autograph stuff, pictures, everything. Taekwondo stripes poster, everything.
Oh, wow.
And it's signed. And yes, and he has a little letter, and he says, it was really the second box. The first box came from Peter Irvin. But the second box I actually got was Master Jim Ray. And he says, Gary, please, thank you so much. Thank you for what you're doing for the Sport Card Museum. That's one of my favorite stories about Master Ree. And I know you've got hundreds of stories, but tell me one of your favorites about Master Ree. Tell me your absolute favorite. I'm putting you on the spot. That was my favorite. Tell me yours.
Oh, my gosh. I would have to say favorite is probably Mr. Ree when his I have two, actually. When he's working to create trying to perfect his safety equipment, headgear, gloves,
wow,
all of that. One of them is, you know, Mr. Ree had beautiful, beautiful antique stuff. And one of them was he had a beautiful, beautiful dining room table. It was antique. I mean, you're talking about, it's probably worth, you know, thousands of dollars. And he would just get an idea pop up, and he would get his safety equipment material, and he would get those box cutters and cut safety equipment on top of the table. Mystery would just go nuts. Oh, you know what you're doing to this table? Like, oh. You know, I mean, think about it. You're not putting a cup of water and leaving a ring mark. He's cutting with the box cutters, stage equipment on this beautiful antique table. I mean,
oh, wow.
So that's one, you know, and he has an idea. He's going to take care of it. Second one is he would be driving in D.C., Virginia traffic, with his headgear on in the car.
Really?
And people will look at him.
I can see that.
About,
that's
again,
so funny.
This is early 70s because he wanted to make sure it was comfortable. You know?
That's wow.
So we would watch him. Oh, there comes a mystery. He's wearing his headgear.
That's so funny, Dad. Let me share the equipment story. You know, I was with Sam in the early 70s, and I remember Sam calling the meeting together with Bobby Tucker, Jerry Rome. I mean, you know, you remember those guys. And he says, this equipment is going to change the industry, and I want you guys to all put it on. I hated it. I hated the equipment. I hated the I remember Sam got so mad. One day he says, look, I'll tell you what, for every person you knock the wind out of or, you know, stop somebody with the equipment on, I put a notch in it, and for every five notches, I'll buy you dinner. I said, Chinese food, Sam? And Sam goes, yeah, Chinese food. I said, okay. When I left Sam, I had 14 notches in my safety hands, you know? And that's the only reason why I really like the equipment. And then he introduced me to, if I wore a size 10 shoe, wear a size 8 foot.
Oh,
no, so
that's the trick.
So the heel and the ball of the foot sticks out, you know? But God bless Master Ree. God bless. I love talking about him. And thank you for letting me have the memory that I had of the Super Grands, even though it's a sweet and sour memory, but it's more of a sweet memory, you know?
Yep.
Now, you're part of the history, without a doubt. And, you know, I've done this for 20 years, the Sport Card Museum. It's been an uphill battle, but, you know, I've got 250 history generals like you, little brother, that help motivate me every day. I've lost a lot, you know, to various things through life. But how do you feel, John, about being part of that history, knowing that through the years, like this radio show and other things that you've done will be documented and people will remember 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now? You know, more, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's first of all, it's great to watch and have been part of the evolution of martial arts. You know, I came at the right place at the right time. I saw the, you know, first of all, the traditional martial arts, when I started, grow into where children, little guys, were accepted, because I started a children's program with June Lee back in 1972. And until then, there weren't any kids. But with the kids coming in,
I remember when
now,
there were kids in karate.
Yeah, they were around.
People laugh at me, but I remember when there was no women or kids in karate. You remember that,
right,
too?
I mean, yeah. We had women, but there really weren't that many and no kids. And like
right.
I said, I was 12 years old, and I was, you know, not youngest one, but I was, you know, that was the age. You were a teenager. And we could not get black belt until you were 16. And I got my black belt 15. I was the youngest at that time, 15 years old and 4 months. And I had to get a special permission from my instructor and another instructor and also from a Grandmaster Reed. So, you know, I was able to get my black belt. And then, you know, we were, you know, times changed with, like you said, musical kata, musical forms being introduced by Grandmaster Jun Ri. And that evolution, that, you know, changed the tournament circuit with the open forms. You know, kickboxing coming into play with the PKA karate being on ESPN. I was part of the, you know, production in the background, setting up fighters, you know, helping out Jeff Smith and Mr. Ri, getting the fighters ready in the rings, setting up, you know, putting up the scaffolds with the ESPN guys, putting on a show once a month. I mean, just think about that. All this productions that's coming into play and, you know, being part of that evolution when ESPN was just coming up. I mean, you're talking about this was before MTV, before ESPN.
Right.
There was no, you know, cable show. And so when it was coming up, PKA came up at the right time, ESPN, Full Contact Karate, you know, with Joe Corley, all those guys, it was just right time at the right place. And, you know, I see the evolution of all these martial arts schools popping up, you know, every other city, every other corner now. I mean, it's when somebody says, wow, you know, tournament's gotten smaller. Yeah, but there are 20 more tournaments now where before there wasn't that many. You know, like you talked about, you have to pick and choose. Martial arts schools, some schools are doing fantastic, but there are so many schools, you're not going to have 300,000 to 400,000 students in every schools. So you're talking about, in terms of numbers, martial arts craze is going. I mean, just any movie that you see, TVs, movies, you cannot see any of those shows without either martial arts being mentioned or seeing in action.
Amen.
Hollywood
for that. We have to think about this, John. Everybody that's in Hollywood today or in the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s, they all pretty much started in the sport karate somewhere or another.
Yes. Yes.
They all did. So that's a really good point. You know, the other thing too, John, is that, you know, you'll go down in history, and these aren't just words, but this is, like I said in the opening of the statement, the critics, magazine editors, everybody said that you were definitely one of the greatest kata performers. Every day I know you're humble, and you've said that to me today on the interview, and I really appreciate that. But, you know, John, I want to share something with you that I wanted to say to you personally on the air in front of my hundreds of listeners and to the peers that are listening. There's very few people, and I was there for 50 years, not all the time with you, but I was there for a long time in sport karate. There wasn't too many people that got me up and got me fired up to watch and to always be there in the nighttime finals to watch you perform, and you were one of them. You really, really excited the martial artists and most of us. And I want to say thank you, John. Thank you for what you did for us and the motivation you gave so many people. And not just as an instructor, but for who you are as a competitor. And I think tonight you've explained that to me in a very special way, that when people listen to the show tonight, they're going to understand what makes a champion champion. And I don't say that lightly, but you are a champion champion, John. And I wanted to say that to you, brother. You mean a lot to me.
Thank you for those kind words. And, again, thank you for what you do. Thank you for... you know, your passion, because that's what I feel. I'm passionate about martial arts. And thank you, everybody out there kicking and punching and doing what they do, because it is for joy. It is for the love of martial arts. You know, it's for individual. It's for yourself. And again, you're not doing it for anybody else but for yourself, but it is pure passion. And when the martial arts bug bites you, it's for lifetime. And I'm bitten,
yes,
and I'm still going.
Well, you know, John, I want to ask you a question, and this is my last question for you, put pressure on you.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Say a kid walks into your school, and you happen to be, not that I say you do it, and I'm sure you did it, you mentioned earlier, and you were, say, cleaning the school, and everybody's gone for the day, and you just happen to be there. And a kid walks in, young kid, and he looks at you and he says, "Why do I have to take karate?" What would you say to them? How would you introduce karate to that young kid who's never seen it before or been brought up on Nintendo or on the movies? Never seen a real karate champion before like a John Chang, not realizing who he's talking to. What would you say to that kid?
Well, I mean, I think it just goes down to the basic human nature. Any kid, I say, and I talk about it in class, when you do martial arts, when you do taekwondo, you do it because you want to get stronger physically and you want to get smarter mentally. And you want to have fun doing it.
Yeah.
And if that's what you want to do, then you can do taekwondo. Then you can do martial arts. But if you don't want to get stronger, and if you don't want to get smarter, and you don't want to have fun, then martial arts or taekwondo is not for you.
Good answer. Good answer from a champion's champion. One more hardcore question, little brother.
All right,
what would you
keep, bring it on.
Today, in 2018, a champion today in kata, and if they humble themselves, which I'm sure there's a couple of guys out there that really realize who you are, what would you say to them? And they've already proven themselves so-called being a champion, but to give them the edge, a John Chung edge, what would you tell them what to do? What would you suggest for them to do to make them a John Chung caliber type of competitor?
Oh, boy, these guys out there, they're great athletes. They don't just do martial arts. Some of them are like super, they can jump, fly. I mean, you know, they can do almost like, you know, unimaginable stuff that they can do. You know, some of them you look and you say, "Whoa, was that a camera trick or was that for real?" You know what I mean?
I'm not talking about the technique, John, because you were perfection of technique. I'm talking about the heart. What would you pass on to them?
You know, I would tell them, continue to enjoy what you do. That passion that I talked about. Continue to just enjoy what you do. And that's when I stopped competing, when I didn't enjoy competition.
I'm glad you answered that.
Yeah, not because I didn't win, or not because I felt like it was too much work. You know, I didn't enjoy the competition. I think maybe because, you know, like you had mentioned earlier about different organization tournaments, it became a little bit too political for me.
Yes.
So I felt like it was time for me to step down, you know, because I wanted to still have that fun.
What tournament did you retire in, John? What tournament was your last tournament?
My last tournament, it was 1984 that I stopped competing in the United States.
Okay.
When I did that a circuit. I think it was a Karate Illustrated at that time. It was before NASCAR and before NBL, when all those were together. So it was part of NASCAR and part of NBL with the Karate Illustrated. And then I competed again in 1985. At the Walker World Championship, and I won, gold in forms and bronze in fighting. And then I had officially retired. And then they asked me to come to Germany again in '87. I trained for it, and I took silver in forms, and I didn't place in fighting. So, you know, officially I retired '85.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, what's the future for John Chung?
Continue to enjoy martial arts and continue to make sure try to do a little bit of workout, some form of a stretching, working out every day to stay healthy. and enjoy, you know, my same philosophy, try to learn something and be happy.
You keep this enjoy and be happy. I love that. That's what I remember. I love about you, John, because you're really sincere about that. You know, I've got to ask you just one more thing, and it's just something on my heart. 3 years ago, I invented Cotta Wars, where I invited people that won 100 first places or more and being judged by people that won 100 first places. What do you think about that concept? I mean, it's been very successful, but you were one of the people that I thought about when I invented that. Do you think anything like that would ever happen? I mean, I can't believe I'm 3 years old now.
I remember spending time
on the phone with you talking about it.
I mean, I like the concept. I think you should continue the concept. And again, because of, you know, again, talked about politics, because of so many different organizations, you know, sometimes it is hard for some people to understand the just pure concept of competition.
Sure.
And not worrying about ranking or rating or points here, points there. So once they understand the concept, I think they'll enjoy just the fact it is just a pure competition. It has nothing to do with anything else. You know, it's not about this organization or that organization. It's about a competitor going out there to compete and doing best they can and enjoying your peers, enjoying other competitors, do what they do best, and appreciate each other's hard work, appreciate each other's so-called perfection, so-called appreciating, enjoying each other's talent. You know, it doesn't matter. I do Taekwondo, but, you know, when I see a great Japanese stylist, you know, Chinese stylist, Kung Fu stylist, you know, I don't say, wow, that was a great Kung Fu, or wow, that was a great karate. I just say, wow, that was great. It was just great. It was good.
Well, you inspire me, John. And again, thank you for tonight. It's been so, I am. I feel like I kid a Chris this morning talking to you, John.
Well, thank you.
It's been so much fun. And
it's always
and
good talking to you. Always.
Yes, it's so much fun. And tonight, like I said, people who didn't get to listen to the show or listen to it now, they'll get to listen to it later. It'll be on the network, and you'll be there forever to be archived. So I want to say thank you again for being on the show, John. And thank you for opening up my show. You know, you've opened up my show every show for the past year, so thank you for that, too. God bless you for that.
I appreciate that.
And,
thank you.
You're one of the guys I work hard for, so... With that said, I'd like to say good night, John, and thank you for your time tonight. And next week we'll be talking to Jason Holmes.
Jerry, my brother, thank you for doing what you do, and I look forward to seeing you soon. I think you're going to be in D.C. area in August, right?
Well, that's my birthday. I'm going to – haven't decided yet, but I might celebrate my birthday.
We'll have Chinese food.
See you in just like we did at the festival. Absolutely, little brother. Oh, God bless you, man.
And you don't even have to earn anything. You just show up, and we'll have Chinese food. How's that? You don't have to knock
on anybody. No Nazis in the gear, huh? No Nazis in the gear.
Nope.
And by the way, before I say goodnight, make sure that you give a big hug and a big oof to Grandmaster Junior Ri and tell him that I love him and I think about him and we talked about him tonight. You know,
yes, and we would like for all the listeners to, you know, pray for Grandmaster Junior's health. He's doing well, but, you know, he can always do better. So pray for his health and his well-being. God bless Grandmaster Junior, and we thank him for all of his hard work and dedication. So please keep him in your prayers.
It was fun talking about him. I really, really enjoyed it. And I love talking to you, John. So with that said, I'd like to say good night, everybody. Aloha to my friend John Chung. And we'll see you next week with Mr. Jason J. Dog Holmes and the producer of the Jamal Nationals in Houston, Texas. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you next Tuesday night. God bless you. Mahalo. And aloha.
Good night.